Good morning. You're listening to 88.7 WHCL FM, Clinton, New York. I'm your host, Pete Bianco. This show is The Ringer. And in the studio with me today, which is a treat, I usually have to interview people over the phone, is Susan Goodyear. And she has written a book, No Votes for Women. And welcome, Susan.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So your book, No Votes for Women, is about the women who opposed women getting the right to vote.
That's right. In New York State, I focused
specifically.
Specifically on New York State, yes.
And what brought you to want to investigate this issue, or how did you get onto this topic?
When I was an undergraduate at Casanova College, I was exploring all kinds of options because I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. And one of the things I was thinking about was textile conservation. So I went to work as an intern at the Lorenzo Historic House. And while I was there working with the textiles, I went into a room and found a stack of magazines and brochures and publications, the anti-suffragist and the woman patriot. And I looked at them and I couldn't figure out what they were. And began to kind of skim through them. And what is this? Anti-suffrage? I'd never heard of it. So it got in my mind, and when I went on to graduate school, instead of exploring textile conservation, I ended up exploring suffrage and anti-suffrage. And the more I explored, the more I realized that not much had been done on the topic, and that it was wide open for me to look at.
Well, that's very interesting. I had never heard of that there was a women's anti-suffrage movement anywhere, let alone here in New York. And New York has a rich history, and I always am excited about learning things of the local history here. And so then once you had your interest peaked like that, where did you go to find some of the documents that you used for the book?
That was a challenge. Probably one of the most important To me, one of the most important collections was the one at Lorenzo. It happened that one of the former owners of the house had been one of a local president, the president of the Casanova Anti-Suffrage Society. And she had collected every book she could. She collected three or four scrapbooks full of newspaper articles, every pamphlet, everything that could have been published. Well, nobody had looked at that.
Wow.
And so because I had worked there, they knew me, I was able to go through all of those. And then while I was writing, so maybe halfway through the process, they found another collection of materials at Lorenzo. And so I was able to use that. No one else had ever seen it. But then I also went to other archives, such as the Schlesinger Library in Boston, in Cambridge, actually. And I had grants to do research at various archives around the country. I would write for research grants. And so I spent some time in Bloomington, Indiana, researching one of the women who was involved in the organization. I was at the American Jewish Archives in Cincinnati, and spent time with another one of the women's papers. But there were no actual collections, and there were very few of the women that I studied that actually had left collections. So it was going into suffrage collections, looking at them, and finding what they had collected on anti-suffrage. So it was a lot of footwork.
Forgive me for being ignorant on the subject, but what is the time frame that this was happening?
I started it. This book started as a dissertation.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant the time frame of anti-suffrage movement.
Oh, of the anti-suffrage movement. It started around 1894 and ended when women got the right to vote in New York State in 1917.
Wow.
And so it was in that span of time.
That's quite a while. It seems like a long struggle for them.
It was. They didn't start as early as the suffragists. The suffragists actually started their movement just after the Civil War. And so maybe 1868, 1869, and then their movement continued until the federal amendment was passed in 1920. So theirs was a much longer, actually a much longer movement.
I don't know if this is part of what you were studying, but what was encouraging women to want the right to vote at that time as opposed to sooner or later? Because I know you're focusing on the women that didn't want women to get the right to vote.
Right. I think it's tied in very closely with developing this new country. And things took longer 100 years ago or 200 years ago or 300 years ago. So the Revolution, the American Revolution, and so the late 18th century, and then moving into the 19th century, it's setting up this republic and nationalism and those kinds of ideas. And they did trickle down into other groups. Originally, it had been intended for white men.
Mm-hmm.
And as time went on and the republic is shaping itself and determining what it's going to be and what it is, women became more involved in thinking about their own place in society, in this United States, and began agitating for more rights. At that time, prior to 1848, women did not have the rights to their own children. They didn't have the rights to their own property. They didn't have the rights to their own earnings. Their husband could make a will, and their children could be taken away from them completely. And they had no recourse. So women began agitating for their rights. That movement, rights in a general way, that movement was really interrupted by the Civil War, 1861 to 1865, and women put aside all of their own needs to help with the war effort, whichever side they were on. Mm. And then after the war was over, when the former slaves were being incorporated into the nation, and black men were considered citizens, and the Reconstruction Amendments began to give these rights, women said, what about us?
Mm-hmm.
Where are our rights? And black men actually had the right to vote with the 15th Amendment way before, that was 1868, 1869, when black men had the right to vote. And here are all these white women who did not have the right yet. So that's when the agitation really began.
And so then, to think about that, why would women not want other women to get the right to vote? I mean, I think that's a very intriguing question.
And the answer, I think, the answers in plural are even more intriguing. One of the things to keep in mind is that ideas about gender were very different 100 years ago, 150 years ago. What an individual wore determined whether they were a man or a woman. So, for example, Mary Walker, who is another New Yorker, who was actually involved in the suffrage movement, but who was a trained physician, worked as a doctor during the Civil War, and had to get special permission from the United States Congress in order to be able to wear pants. Just to give you an idea of how significant clothing was. Well, the women who argued against getting the right to vote were very much of the mindset that voting, as it always had been, was a very male activity. And that if you, and somehow had the idea that if you voted, you were then masculine. If you didn't vote, you were feminine. Those women who didn't vote, those were feminine women. And so couldn't conceive of voting as something that was gender neutral. And so that was a big part of it, that separation of genders. Another piece of that that's linked is the idea that there was a world for men and a world for women, a sphere. Spheres that women shouldn't cross over and men shouldn't cross over. The work that belonged to men and work separate work that belonged to women. And to a woman, at least those that I was able to research, they believed very strongly in the power of women in their separate spheres to reform the state, to change what was wrong with it, whether it was municipal housekeeping, whether it was the care of the insane, the care of foundlings, children without parents, any of those areas had always been women's realm. And these women that I studied were very much involved in those kinds of activist activities and believed that their power to reform came from their place in the women's sphere.
I was just curious if at that time would teaching be a female or a male role?
Absolutely female. It was cheaper. Women would work for less money. And also, if a woman was teaching, chances were she was single and free to go where she needed to be to teach. And then once she got married, she would step out and there would be more women that would be ready to fit into her slot.
And then for men, what would be an example of something that a man could do, but then that would challenge his gender orientation? Some type of an activity that would be considered, this is not for men, this is for women.
I think you've stumped me.
I thought you were saying something, we spoke yesterday, I thought you were saying something about if men were to be doing something like sewing.
Oh, yes. Sorry. What I was referring to actually was some research that's been done on a woman, Thomasina or Thomas, depending on the records. The courts actually struggled with the idea of whether she was a man or a woman. This was from the colonial period, so much earlier on. And one of the factors was that she dressed as a man and yet could do very fine hand embroidery. And that seemed incongruous to the people of the community. And it actually went into court. And we have the court, part of the court transcripts. We do know that ultimately the decision of the court, after much examination, was that she would wear a cap, a mop cap, like many of the housewives of that time would wear, and trousers and an apron. And that's how she was, and she was accepted into the community, he was accepted into the community in that way. That was to give you kind of an idea of how different gender was perceived in those days. Mm-hmm. So yes, embroidery would have been one of them.
So that's quite different than our ideas of gender now.
Very different. Very different.
What other factors played into women not wanting women to get the right to vote?
Some very selfish reasons. This period, 1890 to 1970, was also a period of massive immigration. Tremendous numbers of people were coming over from Europe especially, and Eastern Europe, and coming and settling in the United States. Most of those people during that time were coming into Ellis Island and beginning in New York and then maybe moving out later as they were able to afford to do so. But New York State had an awful lot of immigrants. And many of those immigrants, once a man became a citizen, he could vote. The women couldn't, and many of them couldn't speak English. And one of the factors for these anti-suffragists was, we don't want these so-called illiterate women to vote. We don't want black women to vote. We don't want any of this, in quotation marks, riffraff, to have the right to vote. And we're willing to sacrifice our right to vote so that they don't get the right to vote. So there was that kind of societal change going on at the same time. So that, yes, that was another factor.
These women weren't, the women who didn't want women to vote weren't united in their reasons. They came from different mindsets on why they were opposed to suffrage.
Well, I think it was more a matter of collecting every reason they could find to argue their point of view.
Mm.
So whatever way they could argue, and they would make posters of their lists of why they felt that voting was unacceptable for women, that they were involved in the women, they called themselves involved in the, said that they were involved in the women's rights movement, the women's rights not to vote, not to have the responsibilities of government imposed upon them, that they were unwilling to have so much additional work handed to them when they already had all of the work of the homes, the children, the care of their husbands and their involvement in the communities, their social reform work in the communities. So they would collect all of them, everything, any argument, men's arguments against women getting the right to vote, and they would solicit those statements from those men. So there were as many reasons as they could find. So they didn't necessarily agree on every single point, mm-hmm. but they wanted to accumulate all of these reasons to strengthen their arguments, just as suffragists did. Mm-hmm. Suffragists would look in every nook and cranny for more arguments about why they should have the right to vote.
And what were the some of the men's reasons to deny the right to vote?
Probably one of the most predominant reasons was connected with the idea about what it means to be a citizen. And for men, being a citizen meant that you also would take up arms to defend the country, that you would have a military responsibility. Now, we know perfectly well that many of the men who voted were way past the age of being useful in the military.
Mm.
But even so, the idea of voting and the military was very closely connected. So they would often link bullet and ballot, and you know, without the bullet, there should be no ballot, and that kind of thing. So that was one of the men's favorite arguments. Another argument was that women were simply not strong enough physically, and some men would say not strong enough mentally, to be able to do the research and the reading that would be required of a full-fledged citizen who had the responsibility to vote for people in office and so on.
In your research, did you come across any women at that time who were so bold that they wanted to get into the military, or did that idea not come in until later?
Other scholars have spent a lot of time looking at women in the military, and there were the research has shown that virtually every war there were women disguised as men who did. Deborah Sampson during the American Revolution actually got a pension from the United States government finally. It took a long time and it was a very small pension, but she had served as a soldier dressed as a man. There were others. There were approximately during the Civil War, approximately 450 women on both sides that they know about that actually served.
Wow.
But again, disguised as men. And at that time, there weren't the medical tests in order to get into the military. You just wore loose clothing and would say, yes, I want to join the army, and then you would go in. There was a Private Lyons was one of the women who served and was actually never discovered to be a woman, and she died while in service of an illness and was buried. Nobody ever took off her clothes. Nobody ever knew she was a woman. But we figure there were about 450 during the Civil War. Later on, it got more difficult for women to disguise themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's surprising as well. I mentioned the book, and I've been mentioning this interview to a number of people, and some reactions I've gotten is, well, it must have been the women's husbands who were putting them up to this to be against the women's vote. Is that anything that was documented?
Well, that was what Susan B. Anthony thought as well. Susan B. Anthony traveled around New York State in 1894 when the anti-suffrage movement began and would talk about getting the right to vote. There was going to be a constitutional convention, a New York State constitutional convention in 1894. And so in the months prior to that, there was a lot of agitation. Women should get the right to vote. This should be put into the Constitution. And Susan B. Anthony was asked, what do women feel? What do they think? Do they want the right to vote? And she said, they don't oppose it. And the anti-suffragists said, yes, we do, and began their activism. Susan B. Anthony was sure that it was the husbands that were putting the women up to it. I think that the truth is closer to the women felt that way and the men also felt that way. And like in many partnerships, there's a similarity of feeling. Many of the women that were involved in the anti-suffrage movement were elite women, married to, very often, lawyers, people who were already men who were involved in politics in one way or another. And so, and adding to the arguments that they made, well, if we want something changed, we can just go to the men who are in power and ask them, and they will change things for us. They had the ear of many of these men who were in power. And so it's really kind of naive to think that all women have access to men in power.
Right.
But they did. So I suspect that they were more in agreement in a natural way. I don't know of any marriage that was divided by woman suffrage, that one would be anti and one would be pro-suffrage.
Right. What was the size of the anti-suffrage movement in New York State?
We don't actually know. The reason we don't know is because there is no actual archives that contains a collection of the organizational records. And the anti-suffragists themselves claimed thousands of women. Any woman who was silent on the issue, they claimed.
Oh.
So they would claim the majority of the population in New York State. And but it was we don't know the exact numbers. Maybe it was 20,000. Maybe it was 10. Maybe it was 5. We really don't know the answer to that.
So if they claimed that they had the majority, then how did they end up? How did women end up getting the right to vote if this group is saying that the majority of women didn't even want it? Was there indication that as the movement went on that people changed their position on it, or was it just that it was up to the men to vote for women to get the right to vote, so it didn't matter what the women were saying behind the scenes? How did that work?
Well, for one thing, when we start this period of agitation for women getting the right to vote, and we think back to 1848, in 1848 and 1868, the idea of women voting was so radical and so different from what anybody had ever thought of prior to that, that there were many people who were in opposition. As we move forward in time and move closer to the turn of the century, to the beginning of the 20th century, the idea of women actually voting became less and less radical sounding. At the same time, women in the West were being enfranchised state by state. The first one, Wyoming, when it was still a territory, and then when it did become a state. And so slowly but surely, the Western states were enfranchising women. There were fewer women, fewer people altogether. And so women would often have the right to vote there. And even though women in New York State and along the East Coast were exploring what was going on out in the West where women were voting, and all these dire predictions weren't coming true. So it became more and more acceptable as we got to the beginning of the 20th century. So in actuality, the suffragists were gaining prominence, gaining acceptance. Mm-hmm. More and more people were getting involved in the suffrage movement. It was a lot of fun. A lot of new kinds of media were being used. They were using those. They were experts at the use of media. And the anti-suffragists were kind of struggling to keep up with that and to be as appealing in their points of view. But their ideas were already old-fashioned by that time. They were already no longer quite as exciting and quite as acceptable. So they were beginning to lose ground already. And so fewer and fewer people were as opposed, including men. Then World War I happened, or the Great War, it was known at the time. And the suffragists worked for war preparedness, supported the efforts, were involved in some way. Some were peace activists. Some were completely neutral. On the other hand, anti-suffragists, everyone that I researched except one, supported either the United States getting involved in the war or war preparedness or something. They did not oppose the war. And they turned all of their attention, including their organizational attention, to that war and stepped out, stopped opposing, didn't have their information in front of the news media as often, and virtually stopped their movement. Virtually stopped at that point. Yes. And women got the right to vote in 1917 in New York.
That's very interesting. So what do you think that is saying about the anti-suffragists, that they were so pro-war?
It wasn't so much that they were pro-war. Oh. And there again, thinking a little bit differently about what they were doing. In their minds, they were being dutiful to the United States government. Suffragists, on the other hand, said, you can't go to war without us being involved in making that decision. Don't take our sons from us if you're not allowing us to be a part of those kinds of decisions. Anti-suffragists said, our first duty is to our homes and to our state. And whatever the state does, we will support.
I see. So it wasn't that they were pro-war. They were just in step with whatever the government was wanting to do.
Absolutely.
Just to go back for a moment to what you had said about it starting out west, it's interesting that there's a reflection of that now with medical marijuana laws, which is another thing mm-hmm. that's going state by state. We're seeing it happen out west, and New York is lagging behind and looking on to the West with curiosity about what this phenomena is.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You had mentioned that the idea was old-fashioned, becoming old-fashioned. And I was just wondering, do you think that continues to happen throughout history, that we feel that certain ideas, that ideas just get old and we need to constantly change as time goes along?
I think it's inevitable. Yes, I do. I think that there are some things that originally were very opposed to, and as more people get involved in talking about those things and reading about those things, some of those ideas become much more acceptable. Gay marriage mm-hmm. is a perfect example mm-hmm. of that kind of thing. It's become more and more acceptable as time goes on. And not just here in the United States, but in other places in the world. So we see those kinds of changes where 100 years ago, 130 years ago, the idea of there being gay people at all was inconceivable to people. They knew that sometimes people had close relationships, but they didn't define them as being homosexual or gay or lesbian. So those kinds of ideas have changed over time.
Mm-hmm. And then as the issue was getting close to the turn of the century, was there any push from people to say, we're going into a new century, it's time for, you know, was the argument made that because it's a new century, it's time for a change?
Oh, yeah, of course. Every, believe me, when I say every argument they could think of that could be used, uh-huh. they would use. It was amazing. So, yes, and that was a period of the new woman, in quotation marks and capital letters. And it was also a time feminism begins to become a theoretical framework for looking at women's place in society. And feminism as a term was first used in 1911. So, yes, it's right in this time. When I say that every argument conceivable could have been used, the sinking of the Titanic in April of 1912 became a very rich area for suffragists and anti-suffragists to draw on as an argument.
So both sides used it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So part of this has to do with the myth of the sinking of the Titanic, the idea that all of the men were gallant and allowed the women to fill up the lifeboats, and the men stayed behind and went down with the ship. And so the anti-suffragists said, look, men take care of their women. It's the law on the land as well as the law on the sea. And so we don't need to be separate to be to vote. Mm-hmm. Whereas suffragists said, no, look at the reality of this situation. In truth, there were men who did jump on the boats, that pushed women aside, that dressed in a fur coat and hid themselves as if they were a woman, and went into the lifeboats and were saved. Any man who survived the Titanic was actually up for criticism, and there were some, and they were considered unmanly, and they were part of the argument that the suffragists had that said, no, men's care for women is inadequate at best. We need the right to vote. So there's a whole collection of, or you can see cartoons and little articles and sayings and all kinds of things that put the Titanic as a center of fodder for the arguments.
Well, what were some of the most peculiar arguments that you came across?
That's a challenging question too, Pete. I think the ideas of women being weak or women being incapable or being too busy to put a ballot into the box, you know,
right.
That how could that be so time consuming? They acted as if putting a ballot in a box would be months. You'd have to spend months doing the research. So that always seemed a little odd. And I think it seemed odd to the suffragists as well.
Well, it also strikes me as odd as that when women get the right to vote, they don't necessarily have to participate if they don't want to. So for the women who are saying this is going to be a burden, we have to do all this other work, well, they didn't have to partake if they weren't into it, but that didn't mean that they had to stop the women who did want that right.
Oh, absolutely. That's the way we would think today. But the anti-suffragists, almost from the moment that women were enfranchised, in November, they were enfranchised in November of 1917. Almost everyone that I researched registered and voted.
Wow.
Absolutely. And put it in their obituaries, or people in their families put it in their obituaries. Oh, absolutely. They were proud to vote.
Wow.
Because the government said they should vote.
Oh.
Men had decided, and they did their duty, and they voted.
Well, that's interesting. So they in that way, they stayed in line with what their values were.
Absolutely. They always did. You know, it's easy to criticize these women and to say they were, one book called them, one of my sources called them mentally unbalanced. Others would say they would, some books, they would denigrate them. They would criticize them. They would laugh at them. And that was one of the things I tried not to do. Hmm. Don't laugh at these people. Let's look closely with respect and see why they chose the path that they chose, why they had those views. And so they truly believed that they had a duty, that they had certain responsibilities as women, and then certain responsibilities as citizens. And they abided by those.
So the women who were in this, who were in the movement to get women the right to vote, ended up convincing the men, apparently, because then it was the men who ended up voting to change the law.
Yes.
At that time.
Yes.
And so what different types of media did they use to get their message out?
Oh, they would have gatherings at any venue that they could find. There would be hundreds, thousands sometimes of people in some Cooper Union or big venues where they could have talks and give speeches and that kind of thing. They published cartoons. Some of scholars have collected all kinds of cartoons, pro and anti. They would have a washing bee that was pro suffrage. The idea that they could woman's place is at the wash tub. She was supposed to be scrubbing the clothes, and it would make a spoof out of that. They would sell donuts for suffrage or cookies for suffrage, or they would sell banners, and they would be both suffragists and anti-suffragists would be at every fair imaginable in Paris Hill, just not too far up from Hamilton.
Yeah.
There was the woman who was in charge of the fair there contacted one of the suffragists and said, the antis have already purchased advertisement at the fair. You better purchase it too, which they did. At the state fair, suffragists and anti-suffragists would have their booths right across from each other, and they would sell pennants, and they would, if they had remembered to get a special permit to do that. So they would bounce off of each other. Suffragists got to be involved in parades, which was very exciting. One time on the beach, they rescued the anti, which was a dummy, from the water. They staged a big rescue because they needed to rescue her from her own lack of understanding. And so they would do these symbolic things. There were lots of those kinds of things. And the towns around there, one time the anti-suffragists rented a small single-engine plane, and they had the pilot drop
literature
right pink literature, because it was always pink, out the window all over that area. So, and antis were not as good as the suffragists, but they would do these kinds of media stunts.
Wow, that's quite innovative of both sides.
Yeah.
Anything about people, women who were on opposite sides of it, but who were either friends or enemies because of the issue?
Yes, as a matter of fact, well, there were several, and they both moved in similar. Both groups moved in similar class sections. You have to be fairly elite in order to be able to leave your children and your home and go out into the streets and campaign.
Hmm.
Either side, to run organizations, to be involved. And so they both had to be of a certain stature, class-wise. Early on, there was one of the women that I researched was in Bloomington, when I researched her in Bloomington. She was opposed to women getting the right to vote. She was married to Richard Watson Gilder, who was the editor for Century Magazine and Scribner's Magazine. And his wife was opposed to getting the right to vote and wrote a letter to her very good friend who happened to live out west. And Helena said in the letter all of her arguments against the vote. Helena was interesting in that she was very an artist, and she was very involved in promoting women in the arts, and actually was head of belonged to an organization that did just that. But she didn't think women should vote. And when that letter came out, she received letters from many of her friends, most of whom supported her. But one woman, a woman named Sarah Shaw, who was the mother of Josephine Shaw, who was involved in workers' rights, and the mother of the Captain Shaw, who was the head of the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, that was the all-black regiment, and who had been killed in the line of duty. She was a friend of Helena. And Sarah Shaw wrote to her and said, "I don't understand what you're doing and why you're opposing votes for women. I've wanted to vote for 40 years. And what right do you have to stop me from voting? But I love you anyway, and I hope that we can remain friends." And I believe that happened a lot more often than just what the record that remains shows us. I think there were many women who saw each other. There was a pair of sisters. One was on one side, one was on the other. And their confrontations made the newspaper quite a bit.
Wow. This is just such a surprising history that I had never considered. So many things here are really just intriguing to hear about. What about black women? Were they on either side of this issue, or they weren't participating in the issue?
They were participating in the issue, not with white women. Segregation was much, much greater, and it was very unlikely for the organizations, the black women's suffrage organization, black women and white women's suffrage organizations, to join. Although my next research, there is one of the suffragists asked the black anti-suffragists to join their movement, but that's not until 1911, and on to the next book.
Ooh.
But there was activism with both, but the groups were really quite separate. As far as anti-suffrage black women, I found a tiny little bit of information about the Bayside, Massachusetts black anti-suffrage organization. I could find nothing else. I do know that there were some black women that opposed getting the right to vote, and it was primarily because they felt that they still weren't going to get the voice that they needed, that they needed to do their work outside of the political sphere. But I couldn't find more than that. And it was one of those things I kept working at, and really couldn't come up with more. I'm hoping that my book will stimulate another scholar into looking much more carefully and maybe having access to some kind of information that I didn't come across.
Oh, that's another good idea, that this is just going to forward a conversation and bring this into the collective consciousness. What about some people think that there was groups that were financing and trying to, pay for these women to be anti-suffrage?
Ah, you mean somebody like the liquor interests?
Yes.
I think every time I've ever given a talk on this subject over the years, as I've been to conferences and so on, someone in every audience asks me about the liquor interests. That's what they were called at the time. But any of the brewers. And the liquor interests, anybody that was involved in brewing beer, anybody who was involved in producing alcohol, that they must have supported the anti-suffrage movement. And as anti-suffragists would deny every claim that the suffragists would make at that time, and the suffragists would constantly try to make a link. Carrie Chapman Catt, who was one of the leaders of the suffrage movement, said, "Stop doing this. We have no evidence." And yet, over and over, speeches would try to link them. And I found no evidence that they had supported the liquor interests, that the liquor interests had supported the anti-suffragists. And if they did, they were very cheap, did not support with money, because the anti-suffrage movement never had anywhere near as much money as the suffragists were able to gather.
And the suffragists, they were getting their money just from soliciting for donations to the cause?
Yes, from soliciting donations, from their fundraisers, which were very successful. And they were supported eventually by very wealthy women. One woman who was had been in magazine publishing left all of her money to the suffrage movement. It took many years for the suffragists to actually get that, because there were lawyers that were taking out pieces, and there were people that were arguing about it in court that they should have gotten some of the money. So the suffragists ended up with only half of what they had expected. And
what time was that between 1894 and 1917 that they ended up getting that money? Was it close to the end?
It was very close to the end, yeah. It was something like in about 1915. Uh-huh. And so it really was a big shot in the arm for the New York State movement, because a lot of the money came directly to the New York State movement. Because that was where the decision had to be made. It was the largest state. It had the most electoral votes, and the largest state in terms of population. And so it was the one to pass. It was the one to where to get women to the right to vote. And so that money was pumped in here and really helped the movement along.
Do you have any speaking engagements coming up?
Not yet, but remember, the book isn't quite out yet. It's the 15th. You caught me first.
Yes.
So I suspect that as the book comes out, that there will be people who want to hear more about it.
And where can people go to purchase the book once it comes out?
Probably on the University of Illinois Press. Some of the people that I know are buying it for their libraries, so it'll be in libraries. I'm sure it will be in this library. Mm-hmm. So then bookstores, they've been advertising the book around, actually beyond just the border of the United States. I was a little surprised at that, but yeah. Apparently there's interest there.
That's exciting. Is there anything that's happening on the 15th in conjunction with the release, or you don't have any?
Not yet.
Okay.
We'll see.
And tell us a little bit about your next project.
Well, while I was researching this project, I kept wishing I knew what suffragists in New York State were doing at that particular time. What were suffragists doing? And so I would have to research, but there was no go-to source for what suffragists were doing. The movement in New York State itself has never been written about directly. I mean, there's been books on what was going on in the city, and I know that there's people doing research on what's going on in New York City, but in the state level movement itself. And so I am looking now at what was happening in the state level, and I've divided the story by the women who were the presidents of the suffrage movement during its tenure. It was, or during its period of existence. It was founded in 1869. It ended in 1917, and there were about seven, eight presidents during that time, and each one confronted specific issues, and her personality was very dominant in the movement. And so I'll be looking very much at the individuals who were involved and their activism and what their issues were in each of these periods of the movement. So I'm really excited about that. A couple of the women already have biographies, which is fine. The rest of them don't, and they were very interesting women.
Any prediction on how long that's going to take you?
Well, I hope it doesn't take 10 years. But it will take some.
Last book take you?
It took almost 10 years from the beginning of it being a dissertation. I proposed it in 2003, and it was accepted as a dissertation. And then all of the revisions, and over that amount of time, I defended in 2007, but then it took many people and many, many revisions to get it to the form that it's in now.
Dr. Susan Goodyear, thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll speak again about your next book.
Thank you.
Thank you.